You're listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. What are the strengths and weaknesses of the Central Intelligence Agency? Since its creation after World War II, the CIA has been criticized for allegedly engaging in certain unethical or immoral operations in the name of national security. Others have lamented the amount of money the agency spends or its occasional employment of unsavory allies to achieve its goals. But my guest today wants Americans to understand a far greater problem with the CIA, the fact that it has been remarkably ineffective for more than 60 years. Tim Weiner covers national security for the New York Times. Tim, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
We should start with this. Every single thing in the book, every quote you have is on the record, which people may not understand is really a remarkable thing for a document like this one. Why was that important to you?
Well, I've been a reporter for almost 30 years, and I've had it up to here with anonymous sources. I really have. They're a little like whiskey and tobacco. You know, they give you a buzz, and they provide stimulation. But in the long run, they're bad for you. And it became possible only really very recently to pull together a critical mass of documentation. When combined with interviews and oral histories, gave you a documentary record of what really happened over the last 60 years.
So in other words, you had to have in your hands the declassified documents that allowed you to go and ask people questions and point to certain things and say, I know this happened already, now tell me your side.
I had to get to a point where you could use the actual words of presidents, directors of Central Intelligence, senior CIA officers, taken down as they happened, and put it together in a coherent narrative, chronological narrative, that people could read and understand. You know, there's a lot of hooey has been written about the CIA over the years. And why should a reader trust something that's not on the record about a secret agency?
What sort of records does the CIA keep about itself? There is a history, an internal history, right?
One of the darkest secrets of the CIA is that it is a government bureaucracy, and it is the nature of bureaucracies to keep paper, voluminous records. There was a push, and credit for this goes largely to Bob Gates, our present Secretary of Defense. When he was director of Central Intelligence at the close of the Cold War, under the first President Bush in 91-92, he made a big push to get the records out. It took the better part of 15 years for the pig to pass through the python to actually get them declassified. But by 2004, 2005, 2006, you began to see some pretty extraordinary records coming out from the Cold War era. Now, I started, and then they kind of peter out as you get to the 80s. We get information from the declassified documents sort of like the received light from a star. That light came out a long time ago before it reaches us. I started covering CIA 20 years ago. And, you know, by keeping good notes, keeping records, keeping up with people, the combination of documents, interviews, oral history reached, in my mind, the point where you could actually sit down and write a book like this.
You were already an experienced journalist when you took this on as a beat, but I'm wondering if you suffered from any of the same sort of mythology that colors the popular perception of what the CIA is capable of and what it might have achieved.
It's true that people think of the CIA as an all-seeing, all-knowing, omnipotent, all-powerful secret agency. They get this from the movies.
Like James Bond.
And
if only
Mission
he were
Impossible
American.
Mission Impossible or The Bourne Identity. And they think it's either Mission Impossible or Get Smart. You know, but it's neither one. It's a relatively young agency in the history of espionage. It's only been around for 60 years. The British have been at this for 500 years. The Chinese have been at it for 2,600 years. The Russians had been at it for 300 since Peter the Great. We had no tradition of a civilian intelligence service in this country. But shortly after the end of World War II, we discovered that, one, we were the greatest superpower on Earth. The sun was setting on the British Empire. And two, coming up behind us, we feared, was the Soviet Union of Joe Stalin. We didn't know much about the Soviet Union or about Mao's China, communist China. We didn't know a lot about a lot of the world. Relatively speaking, we were innocents. Knowledge in this realm is power. If you're going to be a superpower, you need to project your power beyond your borders, and in order to do that intelligently, you need good intelligence. So we set out to get it. It's been quite a struggle.
So there are so many failures that are chronicled in the book that are really disturbing. Starting in 1949, we didn't realize that the Soviets had achieved nuclear technology. A year later, we didn't predict the Chinese invasion of South Korea. Didn't know that the Soviets were moving missiles into Cuba in 1962. Move forward into 1990, and we didn't realize that Saddam Hussein was about to invade Kuwait. What has the agency gotten right?
It's gotten a few big things very right, and it's gotten a number of operations very right. I think the two big things that they deserve credit for, and this is in the book, this is not an unrelieved litany of failure, okay? After President Johnson began to commit 500,000 American combat troops to Vietnam in 65, the CIA in 66 and in 67 tried to tell the president that the war in Vietnam was a political war, and it could not be won by military means alone. LBJ didn't want to hear that. But the CIA under Richard Helms, who was director beginning in the summer of 66 through the end of 72, under Presidents Johnson and Nixon, he kept coming. And I think they convinced LBJ, and I think that's one reason he didn't run for re-election in 1968, because he understood, thanks in large part to CIA, that this was not a war that was going to be won with bombs.
LBJ was not the only president who really just wanted the CIA to tell him what he wanted to hear.
I think let me rephrase that. Richard Helms, who was, I think, probably the greatest director of Central Intelligence in the 60s and the 70s throughout its history, he convinced me in argument that there was only one president who ever understood the first thing about the secret operations of the CIA, and that was George H.W. Bush, because he'd run the place for 11 months in 1976. Helms argued, and I think he was right, that, one, presidents didn't understand what the CIA could and could not do for it. Presidents want their problems solved right now. They want answers now. They want action this day. Espionage can't do that for you. So the president says, well, okay, I don't want to just know what's going on. I want to change what's going on. So he orders the CIA to undertake covert action. Action without intelligence is a fool's errand. It is folly, as we have learned to our sorrow in Iraq.
What sort of influence did George H.W. Bush have on Robert Gates, the CIA director?
Well, getting back to big successes, mm-hmm. I think that during the 14 months from the end of 91 to the beginning of 93, when George Bush the elder was president and Bob Gates, our present Secretary of Defense, was director of Central Intelligence, the place was hitting on a lot of cylinders. And one of the things they got right was they didn't go dancing on the rubble of the Berlin Wall. They didn't go charging into, you know, Estonia and Latvia waving the American flag. They quietly gathered information. And the Cold War ended without anybody firing a shot. Well, except the Romanians. They took out their president, but that's different. They kept their powder dry. That's one of the things that intelligence can do when it works. It can avert a coup against a friendly foreign leader. It can give the president strategic insight, let him see over the horizon. And ultimately, it can save lives. When intelligence fails, soldiers die.
Resolution would be too strong a word probably for the Cold War, given what we have going on now. But is the peaceful dissolution of the buildup of nuclear arms between the USSR and the U.S. and China and other players in there, is that enough by itself to say that the CIA overall has been a successful entity?
You mean that nuclear weapons haven't gone off since 1945?
Yeah.
It's a lot more complicated. The process of arms control, which has been in part abandoned in recent years, requires not only intelligence but diplomacy and military men and women to coordinate, to try to see what force levels make sense. We still have too many nuclear weapons on this planet, way too many nuclear weapons. You could probably deter anybody's nuclear arsenal with hundreds, and there are tens of thousands of warheads. So, yes, one of the CIA's successes is contributing to arms control because, you know, in the earlier days of the Cold War, in the 50s and early 60s, we thought the Soviets had thousands of nuclear weapons. We had thousands. We came to discover when we finally got spy satellite technology up in the air that they had four aimed at us, not 400, not 4,000. So, yes, when intelligence works, it can reduce fear. When intelligence fails, fear and ignorance tend to run our affairs.
It is pretty extraordinary that we went from really grossly underestimating the capabilities of the Soviets to completely overestimating the level of threat that they really posed to us.
And then underestimating again.
Yeah, now we're back in the same place.
Intelligence is prone to failure. It is a human endeavor. We can build all the spy satellites we want at $1 billion a pop, and we do. And we can build all the electronic eavesdropping stations we can, and we try. But at the end of the day, the job of intelligence, Sun Tzu wrote this in The Art of War 26 centuries ago, the job of intelligence is to know your enemy. And the only way to know what another person thinks is to talk to them. And this is the job of spies.
Well, that's a great point, and it comes up over and over and over in the book that there are CIA case officers in the field who don't speak a word of the language of the place where they have been deployed, and don't even really understand the culture.
This is not a CIA problem uniquely. This is an American problem. You may remember at the end of 2006, the Iraq Study Group, led by James Baker, the former Secretary of State, went over to Baghdad, went over to Iraq, and tried to assess what was going wrong there. One of their findings, buried deep in the report, among all the thousands of Americans deployed in the Green Zone, all the thousands of military officers, intelligence officers, diplomats, support personnel, do you know how many spoke Arabic?
A handful?
Six.
Mm-hmm.
Handful plus one.
Yeah.
Well, this is nuts, all right? This is the United States. We are the most powerful country on earth. And we know that the war in which we are now engaged is by and large an intelligence war. It is a war of intelligence and information and ideas. It's not going to be won with smart bombs. It's going to be won or lost with intelligence.
Tim Weiner is my guest. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner from the New York Times. His new book is called Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA. We'll return to our conversation in just a moment. The telephone number, if you'd like to join us, is 1-800-9-3-5-2-2.
Please don't call now. The show has been pre-recorded.
Or you can send email to think@kera.org. Chris Boyd, you're listening to an archive edition of Think. Pulitzer Prize winning New York Times reporter Tim Weiner is my guest. He also won a 2007 National Book Award for Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA. Tim, defenders of the CIA will say, well, it's easy to find evidence of the things that have gone wrong. There are many, many successes that remain classified and by their nature will always remain classified.
I read in the introduction to the book that I know that this is not the whole truth, but to the best of my abilities, it's nothing but the truth. No president, no director of Central Intelligence, and certainly no outsider knows everything the CIA has done. And I agonized about this question because you don't know what you don't know. After talking to 300, roughly, present and former CIA officers over the years, I think that if the veil were lifted and the totality of everything the agency has done were known, including successes that very few people know about, that the balance would not change very much. Intelligence is prone to failure. We expect a great deal of it, and the agency can't always come through. Presidents expect superhuman acts from the agency, and they are bitterly, bitterly disappointed when the agency can't come through.
Did it take 9/11 for the focus to shift off the Cold War and that dynamic?
No, I think that when Al-Qaeda blew up two of our embassies in Africa at once, we knew. Certainly the CIA knew. Certainly the President of the United States knew that we were up against something new here. Because two at once is not twice as hard, it's 100 times as hard. The agency at that point, this is 10 years ago now, was really falling apart. A lot of people walked out the door after the Cold War ended saying, okay, that's it. We won. Game's over. And George Tenet, who was then the director of Central Intelligence, the third of the Clinton administration, and at that point, the fifth director in 6 years at CIA, he knew, and he has written, that the CIA was, in his words, a burning platform. Now, just imagine this, okay? You're in the North Sea on an oil rig, and it's night, and the sea is stormy, and your rig's on fire. That's not a comforting image for the world's premier intelligence service. Tenet and the other chiefs of American intelligence assessed the situation after the bombings of the African embassies in the summer of 1998. And they wrote in a secret report to the president, unless we fundamentally change the way in which we gather and analyze intelligence in this country, we are going to suffer a catastrophic, systemic intelligence failure. That's a direct quote. And the date of that report? September 11th, 1998. Now, I would argue that the catastrophic systemic intelligence failure came not on September 11th, 2001, but a year later in the agency's reporting on the Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. The agency reported, we all remember this, Colin Powell told us at the United Nations, the Secretary of State, Colin Powell, with George Tenet, the Director of Central Intelligence, sitting right over his shoulder, that Iraq was bristling with chemical and biological weapons. And we went to war on that basis. It was dead wrong. Dead wrong. That is a catastrophic systemic intelligence failure.
1-800-923-5333.
Please don't call now. The show has been pre-recorded.
Our telephone number. Tim Weiner is my guest. His book, recently re-released in paperback with a new edition, is called Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA. Let's speak to Tim in Dallas. Hi, Tim.
Thank you, Chris. Mr. Weiner, I read your book and loved it. And one thing that surprised me greatly was to read that Bill Clinton was probably the most disconnected or disinterested president in modern times in the CIA. And I had no idea, but I'm wondering to what extent you think Bill Clinton's approach to the CIA in his tenure as president led to the intelligence failures leading up to 9/11.
Well, let me start by saying, thanks for the call. Let me start by saying you can't hang 9/11 on the CIA. The CIA was, yes, in part responsible, but the 9/11 was a failure of the American government as a whole. It was a failure of the FBI. It was a failure of the FAA, of the Immigration and Naturalization Services, of Washington reporters. I was one for 15 years, who failed to understand and assess the threat properly. We all fell down. I think that the death rattles that the CIA was going through in the 1990s were in part a result of presidential inattention. Clinton met with his first director of Central Intelligence, Jim Woolsey, twice in 2 years. That's not good. They were also a result of the exodus of tens of thousands of years of experience possessed by thousands of CIA officers who split. They left after the Cold War. They turned in their badges. It was a failure of American diplomacy as well. The CIA, ever since the Bay of Pigs, really, in 1961, has been exquisitely sensitive to presidential command and control. It does what the president tells it to do. And certainly during the first Clinton administration, I'm not sure anybody knew what the foreign policy of the United States was, except to promote free trade, which is outside the ambit of American intelligence. So the CIA went adrift. And, you know, without a strong wind in its sails from the president, the CIA does go adrift.
Let's talk for a minute about logistics, because it's very easy to think about the CIA and to think about someone leaving a briefcase on a park bench and someone else coming along and picking it up. How much of the really important function of the CIA is performed by analysts sitting in cubicles in office buildings?
A great deal of it. 90% of the people who work for the CIA live in suburban Virginia and Maryland, drive to work on the very clogged highways, go to work in little tiny cubicles. The IT is pretty terrible, by the way.
Is that right?
Well, it's hard to have efficient IT when secrecy is your paramount concern and security is your paramount concern.
So there's no working from home.
Oh, no. Security and efficiency are two different things, as we're reminded every time I go to an airport nowadays. Very few, relatively, CIA officers live and work overseas for the clandestine service. There's another aspect of the CIA workforce that is really quite striking. President Bush in 2004, I think the order took effect in 2005 actually, ordered the CIA to plus up its workforce 50%. 50% more analysts, 50% more clandestine service officers. Well, these folks don't grow on trees, you know. And the consequence of this is that today, the CIA workforce, roughly half of it, has less than 5 years' experience. And they're not good to go. They're trainees by the CIA's standards. It's very hard to fix a car going down highway 90 miles an hour, but that's what the agency has been trying to do since 9/11.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Tim Weiner is my guest. His book is called Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA. Let's go next to David in Fort Worth. Hi, David. Okay, we will move on and speak to Jim in Dallas. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Jim. Thank you. How are you?
Great.
I actually have a comment, I guess, but I'd like to ask a question in it. Many people, many writers, many people who write movies and books and stories like you are writing, think that the CIA is, in fact, just a political action group for the administration of the government. Do you see it differently? That's basically my question, I guess.
Thanks for your call.
The CIA is an instrument of presidential power. It is the pointed end of the spear of American foreign policy. Very, very rarely, and almost all these instances are confined to the 1950s, does the CIA slip its leash, so to speak. When the CIA does things that we think are startling, running secret prisons, using techniques that many believe are tantamount to torture, to wring information out of suspected terrorists, or back during the Cold War, the attempted assassination of foreign leaders like Fidel Castro, it doesn't put up its hand and volunteer to do these things. Hey, I got a great idea. Let's go kill Fidel Castro. Yeah, who's with me? It does what it does because presidents tell it to do those things. But presidents don't want to take the rap.
Is the CIA always candid with presidents about everything that it's doing? In other words, after the Kennedy assassination, there was some information that was not given to LBJ.
There has been, at times, a lack of candor.
You choose your words so carefully on that.
It is very difficult to spend your life working overseas as a clandestine services officer. You are a species of legal criminal when you do that. Espionage is illegal everywhere. You are trying to get foreigners to commit treason against their countries, their army, their tribe, on behalf of the United States. To make a career of that, and then come back to Washington and deal with your fellow Americans in a straight manner, takes a special breed of cat. You better have a pretty strong moral gyroscope to be able to do that. Not everybody can. And in the 1950s, the problem really wasn't individual CIA officers so much as it was the director of Central Intelligence, Alan Dulles. His brother was the Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles. Together, those guys had an extraordinary amount of influence on shaping American foreign policy. There wasn't a brother act like them until John and Bobby Kennedy, and there hasn't been one since. And the CIA was a brand new organization, and it was learning by doing, and it was making a lot of mistakes, and a lot of its foreign agents, I don't mean Americans, but I mean recruited foreign agents, Eastern Europeans, Russians, Koreans, Chinese, Vietnamese, were getting killed on suicide missions trying to get behind the Iron Curtain and the Bamboo Curtain. That was a very dark secret, and I think I've laid it out for the first time in this book. Thousands and thousands of people getting greased trying to figure out the first thing about what's going on in the police states, the closed societies of the communist world. Well, Alan Dulles didn't want to tell Dwight Eisenhower about that, nor did he want to tell the Congress. The CIA as a new organization had to project an image of success, or it was going to get eaten by the Pentagon, taken over, which would have been an awkward position since it was chartered as a civilian intelligence service. So, yes, there was a lack of candor. And from time to time over the years, the Iran-Contra situation of 20 years ago, you may recall, where we, the United States, through the CIA and through the National Security Council, sold weapons to the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, skimmed off the profits, and gave them to the Contras in Central America. Yeah, the line between secrets and lies has to be a very bright one, or you get into trouble.
The book also talks about the Baathists of Iraq riding into power on a CIA train.
That's what their interior minister from the 1960s said. We, as a nation, supported a lot of unattractive people in the war on communism. Why? Well, the Soviet Union really was an evil empire, and Joe Stalin really was an evil dictator, and so was Mao Zedong. And in a large part of the world, the moral philosophy is the enemy of my enemy is my friend. But once again, the CIA executed that foreign policy, very rarely made the foreign policy.
1-800-9.
Please don't call now. The show has been pre-recorded.
Let's go next to Richardson and talk to Patrick. Hi, Patrick.
Hi. I just want to say I love your show. Mr. Weiner, I have a question for you regarding the historical proprietary realm of intelligence that the CIA has always had in the past, up until the past 10 years, being foreign intelligence. It seems like in today's day and age, with the addition of the DIA and Joint Special Operations Community, I've heard of a new type of group that's under the National Security Council called the P2OG, which stands for Proactive Preemptive Operations Group, that I guess its definition is the group members would be include operators that they would be able to preemptively evoke responses from adversary and terrorist groups in order to obtain the intelligence they needed. Would that come under the CIA's direct control, or is the CIA now lost its Special Activities Division?
You're quite right. The clandestine service of the CIA does still exist, and it does have a unique role in American government. But the CIA itself has been beheaded as a consequence of the Iraq weapons of mass destruction fiasco, the reaction of the Congress to that was to create an entirely new intelligence superstructure in this country, the Directorate of National Intelligence. The guy who runs that outfit is now the big cheese in American intelligence. The CIA has lost its status of first among equals. The Office of Director of Central Intelligence has been abolished, and I cannot think of any other post whose occupants have held cabinet rank where that's happened in modern American history. And the CIA is now one of 16 American intelligence services trying to fight what they used to call the War on Terror and what the White House is now calling the Long War.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Tim Weiner. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the New York Times. His book is called Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA. We'll return to our conversation. You can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Tim Weiner. The book we're talking about is called Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA. And our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Lest people say that we've only really focused on the negative, there is one really terrific sort of heroic story in the book worth telling. Well, there's more than one. But the CIA managed to get six consulate employees out of Iran during the hostage crisis of 1979 through a really clever plot. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it was a great operation.
I'm surprised it's not a movie, honestly.
I think it should be. And the premise of the operation was a movie. That the operators from CIA posed as people trying to make a movie. And they had elaborate masks for themselves and for the people they were smuggling out. And they got inside revolutionary Iran, set up their, quote, film operation, unquote. And among the American hostages were six who'd made it out as far as the Canadian embassy. And that's the guys they got out. It is a terrific story, and you're right. It should be a movie. Maybe it will be someday.
Well, and I guess they went to such extraordinary detail that they took out ads and Variety and all that to sort of increase the idea that there was veracity to their story.
They set up very good cover. It's a classic operation, and I actually did the first interview with the guy who made the masks for that operation, and you do remember Mission Impossible, right? The old TV
show. Yeah, of course.
Show. They really could make masks like that.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Did you get to see one?
I've seen them, yeah.
1-800-9.
Please don't call now. The show has been pre-recorded.
Let's speak next to David in Fort Worth. Hi, David.
Hi. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes.
Great. Thanks for taking my call. I'm enjoying the show. My question, I'd like to know your opinion on this. I think that's sort of the kind of the elephant in the living room. Everyone's sort of sifting through, you know, what happened with the invasion of Iraq, the intelligence failure, you know, what the president and some of his top advisors were telling us. And I guess what I'm wondering, you know, I'm in my mid-20s and I look at this thing, you know, all these kids and a lot of these people going over there, losing their lives, our kids. I mean, they're a lot younger than me, which is hard to say. I mean, it sickens me that Knowing what a failure this was, whether it's intelligence-wise or political manipulation, what is your opinion on sort of the mix there? How much of it was an all-out intelligence failure, and how much is, you know, a president that is basically lying to a nation? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Let's go back 5 years. It's February 2003. The Secretary of State, Colin Powell, probably the most respected and trusted American in the world beyond our borders, is in front of the United Nations. The Director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet, is sitting right over his shoulder. And Colin Powell is telling the world and the nation, Iraq's arsenal of chemical and biological weapons of mass destruction represents an existential threat to this country and to the world. Those weapons didn't exist. Saddam had destroyed his arsenal in the 1990s. The intelligence was wrong because it was stale. We, the United States, the CIA, had no fresh intelligence out of Iraq since the end of 1998, when the UN weapons inspectors were withdrawn from Iraq. The intelligence was 4, 5, 6 years old. If the intelligence, it's one of history's great what-ifs, if the intelligence had been accurate, if it had been right, if the CIA had had spies in Saddam Hussein's Iraq, a tall order, yes, but that's the mission, isn't it? And the CIA had reported, and Colin Powell had told the world, you know what? There are no weapons of mass destruction. Could we have gone to war?
1-800-9.
Please don't call now. The show has been pre-recorded.
My guest is Tim Weiner. His book is called Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA. Let's go next to Elizabeth in Plano. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. Mr. Weiner, thank you for, and Chris, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just wondering, I'm in the process of reading your book, and I guess I'm just curious about what you feel is the best way to proceed, because I feel like one of the greatest shortfalls or mistakes of the CIA has been like a sense of overconfidence going all the way back to Allen Dulles with Guatemala, and like titling PB success is kind of like one of the first signs of this kind of overconfidence and intelligence taking. But when there's over now that there have been certain kind of glaring failures in intelligence gathering, there's a great deal more criticism towards the CIA and intelligence gathering and kind of less confidence. But I just wondered what you felt was the most effective approach for both Washington's perception of the CIA and use of the CIA and the CIA's own perception of its role.
The next president of the United States, whoever he or she might be, is going to have to grapple with this. I know what I would do. I would create a national intelligence university that would be as important and as professional as the U.S. Military Academy or the U.S. Naval Academy. I would get bright 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds, and enroll them for 4 years. They would learn Arabic. They would learn Urdu. They would learn Dari. They would learn Pashto, the language of eastern Afghanistan. They would learn Chinese. The tough languages that pull down your grade point average, unless you're very focused. And they would learn the history and the culture of the nations where these languages are spoken. And at the end of 4 years, or 5 years, they could become diplomats. God knows we need them. They could become military officers. God knows we need them. They could become spies. It would be kind of like an intelligence ROTC. Except at the graduate level. We have to get good at this. We have been trying for 60 years now to figure out how we run a secret intelligence service in an open democracy. We don't have a draft anymore in this country, and we don't have really the kind of tradition in this country in which people would devote 10, 15, 20 years of their lives to anonymous service for a government agency, even if it is one as mysterious and enticing as the CIA. We need to get that. And that has to come from the President of the United States.
Let's turn Elizabeth's question about overconfidence inside out. It seems to me that the cat is now out of the bag, largely thanks to your book and some other criticisms that we've heard. Has the United States benefited in terms of national security from a very misguided perception of people all over the world that the CIA was, as you said earlier, omnipotent and omniscient?
Well, it can't hurt in terms of a public image, but you can't live on a public image or public relations. Let me draw a contrast to you between the Cold War and the war that's going on today. During the Cold War, it was relatively easier for volunteers, and most of them were volunteers, from behind the Iron Curtain to go to work for CIA in secret, for foreign agents, because the United States stood for liberty, freedom, democracy, justice, and the Soviet Union, be assured, did not. It is harder, relatively speaking, nowadays for the CIA to recruit Islamists from the Mediterranean to the Pacific, in large part because of the way in which we have conducted the war on terror. An issue for the next president, vis-a-vis intelligence. Should techniques tantamount to torture be part of the foreign policy of the United States? A renunciation of those tactics. Certainly John McCain knows something about torture, since he was tortured for 5.5 years as a prisoner of war. The renunciation of those tactics would help the public image of the United States and its military and intelligence services, and probably help us recruit the foreign agents we need to help us figure out what's going on in the world.
What could the CIA learn from the Israelis in terms of intelligence gathering?
Well, the Israelis are very good at languages. They have to be. The Israelis have communities in places where we can't travel very easily, like Tehran. And they have networks based on loyalty. And they are a national security state. We are not, I would argue, a national security state.
We certainly want to be these days.
Well, how could you be a national security state if you don't have compulsory military service the way the Israelis do? I would argue you can't. You're asking essentially, what does the Mossad or the Shin Bet, the Israeli services, have to teach us?
Because they've been very effective, have they not?
Their reputation may be slightly greater than their actual achievements. It's very difficult to make a comparison because Israel is not the United States. We are surrounded by two great oceans, which we thought would protect us forever. I think the only useful comparison we can make in terms of a foreign intelligence and service whose historic experience can teach us something is the British service in the 19th century. They had global reach. They had global empire. And when they went to places like India or present-day Pakistan, to the Raj, they went for generations. I know a woman, a British woman in her 70s, who was born in India in the 1930s. The seventh generation of her family of British intelligence, military, and foreign service officers. They dug into the countries they were interested in commanding and controlling. They learned the languages. They became part of the broader culture. We don't do generations. We do two-year tours.
So what do you see changing in the CIA? What's different now that gives you hope or terrifies you?
Well, everybody knows what the mission is. No doubt about that. Mike Hayden, who leads the CIA, General Mike Hayden, is an extremely competent military officer. He's not a big fan of the New York Times, my employer, but... Nevertheless, he's probably the best leader they've had since our present Secretary of Defense, Bob Gates, ran the place 17 years ago. The CIA, however, is in the 12th year of a 5-year rebuilding program that began in 1996. And it's going to take, I think, probably another generation before they are what they want to be, what they need to be, what they have to be. We need a great intelligence service in this country. And the president and the Congress should do everything in their power to help the CIA succeed, in the mission of understanding the world. The mission isn't waterboarding. The mission isn't buying elections or manipulating the political process in other countries the way we did often in the Cold War. The mission is espionage. The mission is to know the world. We need to have the eyes to see what's going on in the world and see them clearly, or we will fail.
An interesting question to wrap up from Victor in Fort Worth. Do you think there's any chance that by learning more about the way the CIA operates, Americans will stop thinking of themselves as the good guys?
I sure hope not, because the bad guys are infinitely worse. What we need to grow up as a people and stop believing in a child's version of history, a comic book version of history. We are a superpower. We conduct our affairs globally to preserve our interests. We need the best diplomacy. We need a smart intelligence service. We need a great military. If all three of those are not in harmony, we may misstep, we may fail, and we may lose more soldiers.
Tim Weiner's newest book is called Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA. He's in town for an address this evening to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. It takes place at 6 at the Rosewood Crescent Court Hotel in Dallas. You can learn more at dfwworld.org. Tim, thank you so much for joining us.
A pleasure. Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.